shortly before I left India, returned to the United States, I was visiting once again a small Korean monastery that I'd spent the rains retreat in last year. We were just popping in for a few days to pay our respects to the teacher there, Venerable Dayin Sunim, and to see the community. And during that time, they had arranged an ordination for six boys, aged from the age of 7 to 16. So we were persuaded around to stay around for a few days and attend their ordination. During the rains retreat when we were there in 2004, I was befriended by a number of temple dogs, actually eight dogs that used to live around the temple, and then a ninth dog that used to live in the Jetavana. So we became, Westerners who were staying there became an object of some curiosity that we would actually feed these dogs and treat them with affection and kindness, and that this is a slightly unusual. In most of these dogs were somewhat stray, so somewhat looked after. Anyway, when we came back again a few months later, quite a number of the dogs that we had known had vanished and hadn't made it through the winter season, and a few more had been born. And one of these new arrivals was extremely small, a very young puppy, and was very mangy. But I guess this little puppy had heard that us foreigners were a good bet to hang around. And even though we'd been there only a couple of days, we'd started to sort of feed them a little bit and take care of them. Anyway, why this comes to mind was that one morning, just before going to the morning puja, I opened my door, and there in the doorway was this very small, mangy little puppy. And it seemed to have been waiting there for some time, so I opened my door and the puppy came in and immediately scooted under the bench that was just outside the doorway. And it sort of went under the bench and sat there for a while and sort of made itself at home. And then it, after a while, it was started to look around, and then it left the area under the bench and went into the waste paper basket in the corner and knocked the waste paper basket over, climbed inside, rummaged around, made a nest, and sort of sat down inside the tipped over waste paper bin. Then it came out of the bin and left that, and then scooted under the bed, and then went into the area under the bed. Stayed there for a while, made a little nest, and then got up and moved on. Came out from under the bed and then under the shelves along the wall. Went under the shelves, turned around a few times, made a little nest, came out and went behind the door. Then made itself at home behind the door, stayed there for a few moments, and then came out and then went under the bench again. and then from under the bench into the waste paper bin. And I thought, we're getting close to morning puja time. I better draw this to a close. So I kind of scooped it up and brought the puppy out with me and took it out of the room. But it reminded me of a story Ajahn Chah used to often recount from the time of the Buddha, where the Buddha was walking through the forest and they saw a wild dog or a jackal of some kind. And in a similar way, as they were walking along, the Buddha saw this dog, which also had mange, running away from them and hiding under a bush. And then it came out from the bush and hid in the hollow of a tree. And then it came out from the hollow of the tree and then went to a cave, and then came out from the cave and then went into underneath a log, and then it came out from the log and back into the bush again. And the Buddha said, "Do you see that dog running from the bush to the tree to the cave to the log and back around and around again? And then the monks were with him and said, "Yes, Venerable Sir, we see that dog running from one place to another." The Buddha said, "It keeps moving. It keeps rushing from place to place because it thinks that the source of its suffering is in that place. It goes into the bush and then it makes itself at home, but then it finds it's itching. It's uncomfortable, so it moves. It goes into the hollow of the tree, and then because it thinks it'll be better there, and then it gets into the hollow of the tree and it still itches, so it leaves there and goes into the cave, but still it's itching. Everywhere it goes, it finds that it's itching, and it keeps trying to find a place where the itching will stop, but it doesn't stop because it carries the cause of the itching with it. The dog has mange, therefore it itches. So until the source of that the itching, the mange, is cured, then that wild dog will just go from one place to another, and never finding any kind of rest." I guess the story also came to mind because I got thoroughly swabbed with poison oak a few days ago. So, so the realm of itching has been prominent in my experience, but it's the reason why this story is significant in the time of the Buddha and is significant today is that the way that we go from one place to another, like this little puppy that was trying to find a place in my room where it was comfortable, whether it was in the waste paper bin or under the bed or by the shelves or behind the door, everywhere it went, it began to be uncomfortable, so it went to try and find another place where the discomfort wouldn't pursue it. And this is what we experience as human beings. We keep half blindly moving from one thing to another, one situation to another, hoping to find a place where we won't itch, where we won't feel discontent, or everything will feel good and fine and we will be at ease and happy. As I saw one bumper sticker in the Bay Area, "Me somewhere else tomorrow, finally happy and okay." It's the great dream, isn't it? "Me somewhere else tomorrow, finally happy and okay." Maybe in that cave, or under the log, in the waste paper bin. Maybe in Redwood Valley, or maybe in Utah. Maybe out on the East Coast, maybe Hawaii. It's the itch that keeps us moving, and fundamentally the itch is dukkha. This is what we mean, what the Buddha called simply dukkha, discontent, dis-ease, that fundamental spiritual malaise where the heart is not comfortable with the way things are right now. There's this feeling of it's okay, but it could be better, or it's okay, but it's not going to last for long, or it's out of order now and needs to be changed, needs to be tweaked. This feeling in my body, or this memory, this thought, this quality of mind, or the body, or the world around us. Insufficiency, that feeling of lack, that feeling of instability, even if it's not conscious, even when we find something that's utterly delightful. And sometimes people interpret this as the Buddha being a kind of nihilist, saying how can something that's pleasurable or happy or completely satisfying, how can we really call that dukkha or unsatisfactory? If we're completely satisfied, how can it be unsatisfactory? But as is often pointed out, sometimes it's those moments, those times of complete satisfaction that then cast everything else into the shade. Right? How many of us think, "Wow, that beautiful time, that really good summer, back in '83, that was great. Those were great years. Those were really good times. When I was a student, those were great times." Or back when it was early days at Abhayagiri, those were great times. Or back when I was 5 years old, that was really great times. And maybe that's, we do have a golden, beautiful memories, and they were a sacred interlude, but then you say, ever since then, well, you know, just kind of ho-hum. It's been a life of half-bakedness, compromise, and not quite rightness. But then, back then, that beautiful time, then everything was really great. So that by buying into, by investing the heart in some memory, then and measuring everything else against that, then we create a quality of disappointment. We can't know really directly and purely what's in front of us, because we're comparing this with remembered perceptions, some particular mood of a time that, you know, who knows why it was so satisfying at that time, but we've by the very pleasantness of that, by investing in that and by taking that as something inherently and intrinsically independently good, then we distort the perceptions on experience of this, and so that which was good or pleasant becomes a cause for suffering. Or another incident that's often quoted is Ajahn Mahabua, one of the probably the most famous Dhamma teacher in Thailand, who was a disciple of Venerable Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah's teacher. He went to practice with Ajahn Mun and was very keen and committed and diligent and in his efforts, and learned how to concentrate his mind very, very deeply, to the point where he could experience very blissful states of concentration. And you know, you look at all the other books and you hear the Buddha's teaching and states of jhana, of absorption. These are extremely wholesome, bright, noble states. These are qualities that are, you know, highly praiseworthy and desirable. You think nothing wrong with that at all. Great, you know, monk diligently applies himself and develops the absorptions. All well and good. And so then, when he came back to Thanachan Mun after having been away for some time and recounted how he'd been able to develop these profound states of concentration, and Thanachan Mun said, "Well, you know, that's all okay, but actually, what's going to be more liberating is if you don't concentrate so deeply, but you instead focus your mind at just the access concentration, just the enough mindfulness, enough concentration to be able to witness the rising and passing of perceptions and feelings and thoughts, and the coming and going of experience, and develop insight, develop wisdom from simply attending to the mind with that less absorbed degree of concentration, which of course is not so blissful or radiant in some ways as the absorptions." Well, Ajahn Mahabua didn't like this at all. This was not good news to him, because he really liked his beautiful, radiant, blissful states. And so, as I have understood the story, he can argue with Ajahn Mun, and they went back and forth. And he even though he politely sort of acquiesced to the teacher, he went off and he decided, well, I'm going to do it anyway, to sort of enjoy his blissful states. But of course, defying the teacher is not a very good basis for concentration. And that he found he couldn't get back into those states anymore, at least at that period of time. That no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't enter absorption in the same way. And he was enraged, he was furious, that these beautiful things, these beautiful qualities that were so precious and so lovely and so wholesome, so delightful, were now taken away from him. He no longer had access to them. And he's reputed to have said, if it had been anybody else who was responsible for disabling me from experiencing jhana, if it had been anyone other than Ajahn Mun, I would have killed them. So I found that's a very powerful story to me, like that the development of jhana can be a basis for homicidal urges. It's something you would think is amazingly, wonderfully wholesome, But yet, handled in that way becomes a cause for murderous rage. Fortunately, he restrained himself and was ready to listen to Ajahn Mun and also did develop a lot of insight later on to the point of becoming a highly accomplished Arya. But it points to how something that seems to be very, very noble, beautiful, utterly innocent can be dukkha, can be unsatisfactory because of the way that it's handled brings forth that dukkha as its fruit. So getting to the cause of the itch, getting to the cause of dukkha, the Buddha outlined primarily ignorance, avijja, not seeing clearly, not knowing, avijja, meaning not knowing, not seeing clearly, not being aware. When there's the lack of mindfulness, then this is the fundamental, this is the root cause. When there's avijja, when there's ignorance, then the result is dukkha. If we don't see clearly, if there's a lack of mindfulness, lack of awareness, then the result is always suffering. And conversely, when there's vijja, when there's knowing, when there's awareness, then the result of that is peace, is clarity, nibbana. Now when we consider, we think in these terms, and maybe it sounds a little bit abstract, or we wonder, well, what do we mean by starting out with avijja? If we begin with avijja, we end up with dukkha. If we begin with ignorance, we end up with suffering. Talking with someone today is a good example of how when we say, we are trying to meditate, or we see that I'll be benefited by learning to concentrate my mind, or I've been practicing meditation for some years and I have a certain degree of capacity to focus and certain understanding of insight and so forth. But I have a lot of clinging, but my mind clings a lot. I've got a clinging problem, and no matter how hard I try, do a lot of mindfulness of breathing and loving kindness meditation, but I've got a real problem with clinging. So what can I do in order to dissolve the clinging? What can be done to break that up? And this seems all quite a reasonable thing to consider, right? I've got a clinging problem. How can I get rid of the clinging? So then it'll be me without the clinging, and therefore, a happier world, both for me and everyone around me. It seems very reasonable, doesn't it? Or not even just necessarily clinging. Maybe we experience a lot of negativity or fear. So I've got a negativity problem, when my mind is always looking for something to be irritated by or to be griping about or to be complaining about. You can just feel the inner complainer hunting for an object, scanning the world for another thing to be peeved at. That you've got a sort of nomadic peeve, looking for somewhere to go and move in. So I've got to get rid of my negativity problem, or I've got a fear problem. I have to work on my fear, and then when that's gone, then I'll be a happier person. And in just saying those words, so you might be thinking, well, yeah, right, of course. we've all got our own particular issues or aspects of our life that we relate to in that way. But what's significant is just what we're starting out from. If we start out with the idea of I'm a person who's got this problem that I need to get rid of, and when I've got rid of it, then I'll be a person without that problem and I'll be happy. But we don't notice, even though that's because that's so reasonable, we don't notice that we've in just the way it's framed, the way that's held, we are starting out from ignorance. That we're saying, I am a person who has this problem, And from a Buddhist point of view, in terms of Buddhist psychology, that's you're starting out from wrong view. This is ignorance. That to conceive that there is a person here as a separate individual entity, or that fear is a permanent quality that can be possessed by a being. We're framing the whole thing unwisely, unskillfully, incorrectly, not in accordance with reality. So that rather than beginning with that kind of assumption, then what we can do instead is steering the practice when we're employing vijja, when there's that quality of awareness, when we lay aside those presumptions of I am a person who has this particular quality, we can consciously lay that aside and look at the reality of experience in each moment, and to consider, well, is that feeling of aversion or fear or clinging, is that here all the time? What if this is mine, if this belongs to me, what is the thing that it does the owning? What shape is that? What color? Is it tall, short, green, blue? What qualities does that have? Is there an owner? So we can use the qualities of reflection and contemplation to break up those initial habits, and to look and see that actually what we experience is that it's that we presume there's a permanent problem that surfaces here and there, and we presume that there's a me that is the owner because it's experienced here in this subjective domain of experience. But when we use the meditation and the powers of wisdom and contemplation to look, what's seen is that every so often clinging arises. It does its thing for a while and then it fades away. Or fear arises. It does its thing, it fades away. Aversion arises. Just as the positive qualities of affection or of compassion, generosity, wisdom, these arise, they do their thing, they fade away. And that as they fulfill that cycle, as they go through that cycle, there is no owner that can be found for them. There is no there's no being that they belong to. They're not a self, and they don't belong to a self. And the more that we look, or the more that's examined or explored through vipassana, through insight meditation, through reflection, then the more clear that is, that the way that it's been framed as, I have a fear problem, or I have a craving problem, a clinging problem, that we can see, well, actually, what can truly be known is that clinging arises, it feels like this, it fades away. When the thought arises, oh, this is my clinging problem, I've got a clinging problem. That's the I've got a clinging problem thought. That's all. And maybe we can, because oftentimes what happens is we can see that the clinging is empty or the fear is empty, but then the idea of, this is me working on my clinging problem or my fear problem or my egotistical problem. That gets by without a second glance. That's taken as being a true estimation of reality. So when we are developing the capacity of the quality of vijja, of knowing, of true clear awareness, then it's fundamentally a direct knowing of what we're experiencing without any kind of additions, any accretions, any presumptions being made from that. So that when there is that arising of different qualities, we know them for what they are, and then we see what the difference is when we see the feeling of fear arising and ceasing, and we don't add, this is my problem that I've got to get rid of, when we don't add that onto it, then we find that it's extremely uncomplicated. When it's me with my fear problem, or my lust problem, my egotistical problem, my communication problem, my not being loved by anybody problem, or my busyness problem, then or whatever it might be, insert your favorite issues here on the dotted line. It's all extremely tangled and complicated and confusing. When there is vijja, when there's clear awareness, suddenly it all becomes uncomplicated. As Ajahn Sumedho would often say, ignorance complicates everything. Avijja pachaya sankhara. Ignorance conditions sankhara, formations. Ignorance complicates everything. Vijja, when there's true knowing, makes life very uncomplicated. There's a seeing, as the arising of sight, the disappearance of sight, the arising of hearing, disappearance of hearing, the arising of mood, happy mood, arising, ceasing, painful mood, arising, ceasing. Feeling of, wow, at last I'm getting it right, arising, ceasing. Oh dear, there goes the egotist is getting carried away again. It's the, oh, there's the egotist getting carried away again feeling. That arises, that ceases. It too is empty. All of the ways that we create a feeling of self and other, the way that we create me in here and the world out there, we begin to be able to recognize them, to see them with that same eye, with that same, the eye of Dhamma, see them with that same, through that same lens, and to know them for truly and fully for what they are. And that, and when we do, we experience that quality of uncomplicatedness. It's very suddenly life is very simple, very clear, and very open. Oh, this is a kind of practice I find I've been doing a tremendous amount recently, and particularly as I was saying, sometimes we can see the initial experience of liking something or disliking something, feeling comfortable, feeling uncomfortable, the basic beginning perception. We can see that and we can let go of that, but it's the conceiving and the commentating, the kind of moods that we feel often slip by, fully disguised as being accurate assessments of the way life is. But if we take the trouble to not just see the initial experience as being empty, like the sight, sound, feeling, but also the way that we judge other people or ourselves. If we see, we see somebody doing something that's annoying, and say, oh, how can he do that? If we just catch that right there and say, that's the how can he do that feeling. That's the, and then we have a conversation with someone, and maybe we fumble what we're saying, or we kind of contradict ourselves, and then we feel a kind of flush of embarrassment or insecurity. And then the mind, oh dear, he's going to think I'm an idiot. I'm really incompetent. I can't really express myself properly. Ah, catch it. Well, this is the I can't really express myself properly. Oh dear, what does he think of me feeling? That's all. It arises, it ceases. It's empty. There's nothing solid, nothing substantial there. But if we look at our own lives, the way that all of our minds work, each one of us has a, I'm sure, not that I'm a mind reader, but just by guesswork, I would say we each have our own array of patterns and judgments about other people, about the world, about ourselves, that carry on, that get pursued and believed in without a moment's thought, without any kind of reflection upon them. I've been meditating for 30 years and I really haven't got anywhere. Thought. oh, this is the, I've been meditating for 30 years, I haven't really got anywhere thought. It feels like this. It arises, it ceases. This is the hunting for a cool place on a hot day feeling. This is the, what can I try putting on my poison oak that will that will actually relieve the itching. Rust Tox is very good, by the way. But we can, if we develop this kind of mindfulness, really taking the trouble to see how often, in how many different ways and moods and modes, those judgments, opinions, feelings, perceptions arise during the course of a day, and we just simply catch them. This is one of the ways one can practice cittanupassana, the contemplation of the mind, of mind states. This is extraordinarily useful because, you know, this is the way that I experience it. As soon as I catch it and say, oh, this is how can she do it? How can she do that kind of thing? She's really being irritating. Again, you know, I can't believe that this person doesn't realize how annoying they are feeling. And even as I'm saying that, you know, you can contemplate, I know he's talking, this is the I know he's talking about me feeling, right? Or maybe he's talking, maybe I know who he's talking about, he's talking about her. That's the feeling, that arises in the present moment. That's also empty, it's not self, it's substanceless. The more fully we catch those reactive patterns, our biases, our loves, our hates, our opinions, we the more that we see, that's just what it is. It's just habit. It's just perception. It's just the conditioning of the mind doing its thing. It doesn't have to be considered to be real or valid or substantial in any way. What I experience as I do that is just suddenly the world gets more spacious, gets less complicated, is clearer and more beautiful. There's an immediate feeling of relief in the heart, like, oh, this is just the, I hope he's okay, what can I do to help him feeling. So there's still the concern, you know, you still have a compassion for another being, but it's not, oh dear, this is now my problem, I've got to do something about it in order to fix, because this person's suffering, how can they be helped? What can I do? It takes the personal out of it. It takes the self and other elements out of it. It just deflates the world creating, the self creating compulsions and habits that we have. It's like when there's ignorance, we impersonate, or we impersonate things, if such a word exists. we make it personal. We concretize the self and other. And when things are seen clearly, when we take the trouble to be mindful and to track the moods and feelings that we create, the solidifying of perceptions, then the heart is relieved. There's a freedom, there's a spaciousness that is the most precious quality. The itch is, the cause of the itch is removed. There's no longer that seeding of our experience with ignorance. It's we're starting with from a basis of vijja, of knowing. We're with truly what is being experienced. Now the doubting mind, or the kind of the inner critic, will say, yeah, you're just trying to wriggle out of it. There's no way you can kind of do this mental juggling act and play around with this ridiculous mind games. You know, you really have got a fear problem. You know, you really have got a serious aversion problem, and you are really an inflated idiot. you really have been meditating for 30 years and you haven't got anywhere. Now, don't you try and get out of it, because you really are completely incompetent. You know, everybody knows this. But even that, just no matter how hard the critical mind or the inflated mind or the opinionating mind, the judging mind, it's like, yeah, but she really shouldn't be that way. if she was mindful, she'd never do that, because it's so annoying, and everyone knows that. It's like, yes, I know it's empty, but still she shouldn't do it. It's the way we practice, is you get behind that as well. This is the yes, I know it's all empty, but still she shouldn't do that feeling. And again, it doesn't mean to say that we've become inert or totally passive in life. But what it means is that we learn to respond to life from a basis of wisdom and a genuine, unbiased attunement to the way things are, rather than through reactive patterns, through the confusion of habit and bias that comes from clinging to views, clinging to perceptions, clinging to ideas of self and other, that each moment and the way to handle each moment and the responses of action or activity or restraint of different ways of engaging with perceptions, those are guided by metta karuna, by loving kindness, compassion, wisdom, mindfulness, rather than by habits of becoming, of the desire to get hold of, the desire to get rid of, the fixed views and opinions that come from a lifetime of conditioning. So I would encourage heartily everyone to develop this kind of reflective quality, this kind of jitanupassana, just watching, tracking the moods as they change, the flow of opinions and creating the world, creating ourselves, and to take the trouble just to notice it, how it works, and seeing what happens when we let it go, just when we simply know that that's what it is. And to witness for yourselves, to see for ourselves how much of a better place the world becomes immediately when that is brought into effect, when we burst the bubble of sankhara, of complication in that way, to enjoy the pure simplicity of the world of Dhamma. So I offer these thoughts for reflection this evening.